You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the latest Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 29th of August to the 4th of September 2013. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by writer Matthew Rice, Deputy Features Editor Paul Jump, and Deputy News Editor John Morgan. We'll be talking about government support for plans that could let students judge universities by how many of their academics hold teaching qualifications. Matthew will take us through this week's culture section, in which he interviews Zoe Svensson from the University of Cambridge about her work on Marlowe's Edward II at the National Theatre in London. And have you ever left an informal note to a colleague in a published version of a paper? Well, one scholar in Australia could be in trouble for doing just that. We'll also hear a little bit from David Matthews. He's not with us here, but I spoke to him earlier about his cover feature on a very different type of university in Spain. But first, our main news story. John, it's written by Jack Grove, but he's not here, so perhaps you're best placed to take us through this one. The government wants students to be able to consider data about how many lecturers have teaching qualifications when selecting their university. That's about right.
Yes, that's right. And there are fears among academics that this government push to gather this data is going to lead to teaching qualifications becoming compulsory, which many academics would feel is rather time-consuming and burdensome, and potentially a very difficult thing to do while trying to maintain a research career. So the latest development is really that the Higher Education Statistics Agency has now said it's compulsory for all higher education institutions to complete data returns on staff teaching qualifications, and now universities are surveying their staff to gather the data about these qualifications so they can make their returns to HESA. And kind of the interesting thing that's driving it is really that HESA's doing this because the government wants it to, and obviously David Willetts, the university's minister, is very keen on, you know, provision of more information for students, so they've got more information about the courses they want to study, and he's also very keen on making teaching something that's important in academic careers to drive up standards, so it's not just research. So it ticks a lot of boxes for David Willetts, and the government has basically said in its response to that it provided for our article that it's it thinks that the teaching qualifications data is information that prospective students may want to consider when choosing their courses, and the government also seemed to leave the door open to this teaching qualification data being included in the key information sets.
So greater transparency. Is there any indication of what percentage of university staff have teaching qualifications, or I suppose the most importantly, what percentage of teaching university staff have these qualifications?
I think that's what the data is going to show. We just don't have it yet, but I think one thing we can say is that most academics are vehemently opposed to the idea of teaching qualifications becoming compulsory, because there was a Higher Education Academy survey on that subject which found that 70% of respondents were opposed to compulsory teaching qualifications.
But could infer that perhaps that means that 70% don't, but that's probably too simplistic, isn't it?
Is there any evidence that a high incidence of teaching qualifications equates to a high score in the NSS or some other measure of teaching excellence?
Then yeah, again, you'd have to wait for the HESA data to come back on that, and maybe you could start plotting institutions with high proportions of teaching staff against high scoring institutions in the NSS. But I'm sure someone, if not us, will do that. It'd be an interesting one to see. But given the level of government support for this, and the fact that it's going to be publicly picked over by students, this data, that will sort of increase academics' fears that it's going to become compulsory.
Indeed, we'll watch how that one develops. Over now to our culture section, though, perhaps cruelly overlooked on occasion by this podcast, but we'll put that right this week. Matthew, you've penned a feature about the National Theatre's production of Edward II.
Yes, well, it's an interview with a woman who's a lecturer in drama at Cambridge, but she's also a theatre director or actually creates theatrical works, and most of them are rather striking, excuse me, kind of interactive, immersive events. There was one where she took a container around the country and people, the audience sort of got into the container, and then there was a sort of a multimedia event as if the climate change disaster was happening in the area and people had to vote on what they would do and whether they would accept climate change refugees into the area. So that's, as it were, her own work.
Very similar to Marlowe's work.
Very similar to Marlowe's work. She tried to make a connection. But she says that what she brings to working at the National Theatre is a sense of all the different kinds of ways in which plays can be put on, and she feels that a lot of the kind of classical tradition of English drama is very performed in a very text, very too reverential to the text, and not wild enough, not looking at the underlying structures. And she acts as what's called a dramaturge, which is a term more used in continental Europe than in England, but basically she works with the director on the structure and how the play unfolds in time and space. And they did a production of The Changeling, a Jacobean tragedy, where all the characters ended up covered in food as a result of a rather wild banquet.
It does sound tragic.
Yeah, it does sound tragic. So I think this should be a pretty spectacular and unusual production.
No, absolutely. If that hasn't whetted the listeners' appetites to read that one in full, then I'm not sure what will. Do check out our culture section. Paul, this week you had an intriguing tale of a note left by an academic in a paper that was subsequently published, with said note still in it. Your words, it's thrown the organic chemistry community into uproar. what did the note say?
They're effervescing wildly. Yeah, there's been a lot of blogs, to some extent, prejudging the issue, which I've attempted not to do. But anyway, the issue is that, specifically in the supporting information, which isn't the main part of the paper, but is sort of extra information that appears online, there's a line in there addressed to, apparently addressed to the first author of the paper, who was a PhD student at the time. And it says, for this compound, just make up an elemental analysis. And for the uninitiated, an elemental analysis is something you do in chemistry. Obviously, the word make up there is the question. Obviously, lots of people have leapt to the conclusion that this was a note written by the senior author of the paper, instructing the first author to fabricate the analysis. The thing is that the senior author isn't apparently a native speaker, and so there's lots of debate as well about whether he actually meant make up to imply fabricate.
And there is obviously an investigation continuing into what actually happened at this point.
There is, yeah. It's complicated by the fact that the paper's from the University of Zurich, but both of the authors in question have since moved on. The senior author's now at the University of Western Australia, which is carrying out the investigation. No doubt that will take quite a while to reach any conclusions, and in the meantime the void will continue to be filled by bloggers reaching their own conclusions.
Oh, interesting. I mean, it's remarkable that it got to the point of publication. I mean, was this not a peer-reviewed paper? Had not passed through a number of eyes before being published online?
It had. The thing is, though, that if it had been in the main paper, I think it certainly would have been picked up, but the fact that it was in the supporting information is probably why it slipped through. I spoke to one senior chemistry academic, and he said he only checked about 10% of the supplementary information, and if he didn't find any mistakes in that, he tended not to bother with the rest. He's a busy man, obviously.
Yeah, I suspect he will. Suspect he will check in the future.
So evidently, everybody else took the same approach, and nobody checked that bit.
But someone's mum has intervened.
Yes, that's right. The first author, well, somebody purporting to be the first author's mother wrote to one of the chemistry blogs asserting that her daughter would never get involved in anything so nefarious as research fraud.
Well, case closed.
Yeah, obviously her mother knows her best, and if that's what her mother says, then that, perhaps that should be the end of the matter.
Interesting. Finally, David Matthews, one of our reporters, penned this week's cover feature about a cooperative university in Spain. He can't join us now, but I did speak to him earlier today, and here's what we chatted about. You've written our cover feature this week, which took you over to a rather different type of HEI in the Basque Country of northern Spain.
Yes, I had a very enjoyable visit to Mondragon University, which is a very, very interesting project, actually. It's been around for about 16 years as a university, but dates back to the Second World War. It's kind of an amalgamation of various colleges in that region. What's interesting about it is it's a cooperative university, so it's owned by all of its staff, and you sort of buy your way into a slice of ownership after you've worked there for 2 years, and then you stump up about €12,000, and then you're a member of the cooperative.
Well, you stump up cash, so you get paid for a couple of years, and then you hand a wadge back to buy a slice of the pie.
Yes, that's right, that's right. And with that comes various things, so you can get that cash back at the end when you retire and sort of cash it in. But it's a pretty remarkable institution, actually. It's very democratic. There's a sort of general council made up of local businesses, students and academics who can kind of fire and hire the senior managers at will. There's a kind of cap on the amount that the top boss, the chancellor, or sometimes called the rector there, can earn. So it's 5 times as much as the lowest paid worker at the university. And that ratio, that gap, is much smaller than at lots of UK universities, where it's, you know, the vice chancellor's earning 10, 15 times as much as the lowest paid worker.
It sounds a bit like the government recently was looking at places like John Lewis and partnerships, whereby you get the buy-in from staff, meaning that they feel, well, financially, but also a little bit emotionally attached to the organisation. They want it to do well, more of a vested interest. Is that the kind of thing that they're hoping will happen?
Yeah, I got that sense very much going around that there's a lot more loyalty to that organisation, that university, than you'd find in UK university. I mean, UK academics, you know, they're not necessarily hold any ill will towards a university, but a better position comes up, they'll probably move. Whereas here, most of the academics seem to be there for a long time. They're very sort of proud of their mission that they were trying to achieve there, which is sort of training and development for a kind of wider cooperative movement in the region. Mm. And yet, that's one of the ideas behind a cooperative, is that, you know, if you don't think of things just as a kind of management problem, that's the idea. You sort of take a bit more responsibility for it yourself.
See the bigger picture, yeah. I mean, I wrote a piece not long ago about two early career researchers who quit UK academia to visit some quite interesting institutions. One of them was the University of the Earth in Oaxaca, Mexico, where there's no compulsory learning, there's no hierarchy among staff. I mean, what did the people at the university you visited in Mondragon make of the more traditional approach of UK institutions? Do you think they were stuck in the mud, or did they... what did they think about the other side of the coin?
You know, you maybe had some preconceptions that would shun other universities, but no, they were pretty open, basically, lots of different forms. They said, you know, our idea isn't, wouldn't work everywhere. And it perhaps goes a little bit with the kind of tight-knit Basque culture there. Whether it would work in England, I don't know. But there's a lot of paradoxes there. You know, a lot of stuff UK academics who are maybe disillusioned with some aspects of UK academy might find really welcoming. But on the other hand, if you're Mondragon University, you have to make lots of your money back from doing paid for research for companies and government. So there's not really any blue skies abstract research there. Mm. And also, you know, the flip side of owning this university is if it does badly, your wages get cut. Rather than you being fired. It's very difficult to fire people. So there's a particular department there, the business department, which is pretty heavily hit by the tough economic conditions in Spain. So I thought it was paradoxical. If you don't want to be worried about money, you shouldn't become a cooperative, basically. Mm-hmm. But it's a very interesting experiment. And I... There's also a bit in this feature about whether it could possibly work in the UK.
And?
Well, very difficult to say. I mean, I spoke to the head of the Cooperative College in Manchester, who trains people in how to become cooperatives and, you know, what their advantages and disadvantages are. And he said quite a few vice-chancellors have been coming to him to scope out whether they might be able to at least use some of the kind of governance or ownership models that's seen in Mondragon in the UK. Legally, I don't see why it would be a problem. I mean, the government has been, as you say, has been encouraging and actually putting up money to get parts of the public sector to turn into cooperatives or mutuals. But whether you could get a huge university, you know, with thousands of staff all to put up a couple of grand and agree to this would be very, very tough. Whether the culture would be there as well, and whether you could get the vice chancellor to take a salary cut if that was going to be part of the plan as well. But I think it's definitely something to think about. It doesn't have to be imported wholesale, and certainly Mondragon weren't saying, you know, we can set this kind of thing up all over the world. But it's very stimulating and very fun. The vice chancellor sort of drove me round from campus to campus in this, you know, beautiful Basque country, and we, you know, had some sort of tapas and wine and things. I sound like I've been bribed, but it was a very pleasant experience, but not without its drawbacks.
Sounds ideal. A remarkable feature, and thanks for sharing a little bit more about it. There we go. That's the end of this week's Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast. If you want to talk about anything you've heard on the show, or if you want to comment online, you can find us on Twitter at Times Higher Ed. You'll find us on Facebook, on LinkedIn, and on Google+. Just search for Times Higher Education. Also, there's a books podcast that came out earlier this week based on last week's Book of the Week. Do check that out. But until next week, that's the end of the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.